Welcome to Hearing the Pulitzers, a piece-by-piece, episode-by-episode exploration of the winners of the Pulitzer Prize in Music, with hosts Andrew Grenade and David Thurmeyer.
Welcome to Hearing the Pulitzers, episode 49, where we're traveling back to 1991 and the 45th winner of the Pulitzer Prize in Music, Shulamit Ron, for her symphony. So, Andrew, it's been a little while since we've...
It has. We've been doing some research.
Yes.
And hitting dead end after dead end after dead, which we'll explain, but that's why this episode was so delayed.
Exactly. And it has to do with... we actually may throw out a question for our listeners about to give some insights as to why the situation is what it is. So we'll stay tuned for that. But first, yes, your experiences with Shulamit Ron.
It's a name that I have seen for decades, and literally I had never listened to any of her music before it came time to get ready for this podcast. What about you?
Well, I grew up in the Chicago area, so she was the composer in residence for the Chicago Symphony when I was in high school, I think, or maybe right as I went to undergrad.
So did you hear the symphony by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra?
No, because it was premiered by the Philadelphia Orchestra and was played in Chicago, but... We don't have a recording, and that's
you didn't attend.
I did not attend that performance. No, I've also not heard her music before researching. So she was a name. I knew she was a Chicago person and a Chicagoan because she taught at University of Chicago for many years. But in terms of knowing her music, not familiar with it. I think she may have been one of the first composer in residences for the Chicago Symphony. Yeah. So that was a big deal, and she had great relationships with the CSO. So, yeah. So, well, maybe let's try to tell the story with at least more information about Shulamit Ron.
Telling the story.
All right, so Shulamit Ron born in
1949 in Tel Aviv.
That's right.
Yeah, so Israeli,
Israeli American composer.
Immigrated to Palestine from Europe before the Second World War as a pianist.
Yeah, so evidently just off the charts, amazing, amazing pianist. Studied at the Tel Aviv Conservatory for a while, then ends up deciding she wants to pursue serious compositional studies. And at age of 14, gets a scholarship, along with assistance from the America Israel Cultural Foundation, to come to New York City to go to the Manus School of Music. And she studies there. We're going to begin to see this steady drumbeat of former and future Pulitzer winners in her orbit. And the first is Norman Della Gioia, who is her composition teacher when she came to the United States. Also took piano with Nadia Reisenberg.
And most famously, you can see this on YouTube. We'll put a clip, put a link to it. But she performed her own concert work, Capriccio, with the New York Philharmonic at a young people's concert.
Which is remarkable.
Yes. And she was 16. Leonard Bernstein didn't conduct it, but he spoke and introduced her. And he said, she's a very talented 16-year-old who's not just a pianist, but also a composer. And it's very rare to hear a young person of this age have such mature music abilities. So she performs this piece. Conducted by Pedro Calderon, and it's pretty impressive, actually.
Well, 1965. This is really, really remarkable that she's performing a piece that she composed with the New York Philharmonic.
Exactly. And just as a side note, a cultural thing to watch, Bernstein mentions, he said, you know, she's a young person like a lot of you in the audience, and the kids just had either really great attention span or they were all on tranquilizers or something because they were the film is like they're transfixed by her playing when they pan to the audience and you can see the audience. Nobody's fidgeting and like today. So it was just very interesting for that time. But yeah, impressive. And so then played another, again, met Zubin Mehta with the Israel Philharmonic.
Yeah, so, played the world premiere of her concert piece for piano. So clearly excellent, high-level pianist. And, you know, I kind of think of someone like Shostakovich earlier in the century, could have gone either direction. Could have been top-notch pianist, could have been top-notch composer, ultimately decided in the early 70s, I'm going to be a composer.
Yes, and it was a fortuitous place and meeting and person she met, who was Ralph Shapey, who, again, longtime University of Chicago composer. And her piece, Oh, the Chimneys, kind of a chamber, it's like a Pierrot ensemble type piece with tape, had attracted the attention of Ralph Shapey. And then at that point, what don't you miss the good old days where you could
that's
just
how
say,
you got a job?
Yeah, like, hey, I know somebody. I think her music's great. Let's put her on the faculty.
We've seen this happen several times.
Yes, we have.
Right? Most recently with our good friend Mel Powell.
Yep.
So we've seen this is a common that was the we've talked a lot about the old boys club, but this sense of in the music world, in the academic music world at this time, this was the way you would get a job is, hey, I like that music. Why don't you come be a professor here at the University of Chicago? She arrives there in 1973 and never left.
Yeah, exactly. And studied with Shapey. He was a huge influence on her. Mm-hmm. Worked with him, asked him to teach her privately as a senior colleague. That's pretty cool to think of that. And yeah, that sort of led to all these great successes in the Chicago Symphony, the two-year post, and our symphony that we're talking about. So she was at University of Chicago from 1973 to 2015. So
which is remarkable tenure.
Yeah, very, very long time to be there.
Yeah, ultimately became the William H. Colvin Professor of Music. I mean, I think the way you started saying that she was a force in Chicago and known in Chicago is clear. If you're at the University of Chicago this long, if you have the position as the composer in residence with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I mean, all of this, right? This is This is the standard composer makes a good story in the United States that we've seen play out again and again. But we're now seeing that the scope is widening. It's not just these old men from the Northeast,
New York area
that we're starting to see. I mean, we've already seen a couple of Chicago connections. We're starting to see some California connections. That as we get into the kind of post 1980 world and that kind of pivot that we talked about, the Pulitzer is expanding. These networks are expanding.
Definitely, definitely.
And we'll also see coming up that Ralph Shapey has his own Pulitzer story.
Yes, indeed. So with all that in mind, we'll do the best we can here as we go behind the notes.
Behind the notes.
So here is the difficulty that we discovered. And we went down so many rabbit holes. And that was to find a recording of Shulamit Ron's symphony. And at first we thought, oh, it's just because it's the most generic title ever. You just call it symphony. You're not helping search engines find your pieces. And we kept finding dead end after dead end after dead end. We spoke to Nara Newcomer, who's our music librarian here. She helped us dig. And eventually you actually contacted Shulamit Ron and said, we can't find a recording. We want to talk about this piece on our podcast. It's an audio format. Mm-hmm. We'd love to have a recording. And what did you discover?
She agreed with us and said she's been unable to get a recording as well. She said it's had various performances by these big ensembles, Philadelphia, Chicago, even recently with the American Symphony Orchestra with Leon Botstein's group. And she said, I'm always turned down. I can't get a recording of this because of, quote, union rules or the unions.
Yeah, this is just remarkable. I mean, it's remarkable on two levels.
Yeah.
And the first level is here is the second Pulitzer Prize winning piece by a female composer. And there is not a commercial recording available.
No.
That's number one. Number two is the composer herself cannot get a recording from the orchestras that have recorded it that she can even review.
Exactly. And so she said, well, why don't you, she said, it's probably not going to go anywhere. And I'll say she was very, really great to communicate with. And I appreciate if she's listening, I appreciate her taking the time to respond to me. But she said, you could try to reach out to the American Symphony Orchestra and here's the person, their leadership or management. Mm-hmm. So I did and explained the situation. And he said, well, unfortunately, due to union rules, we're not allowed to release any bit of the recording to anyone. including the composer. And I said, I don't understand this at all. So that's where this question comes out. If anyone, any of our listeners are in on union rules and restrictions, if you could email us or send us a note or post on X or something, why is this the case? And we both, Shulamit, Ron and I both exchanged in our emails, wouldn't this be beneficial for all parties involved, mm-hmm. for her to get her music out, for the orchestra to have a good recording, and for education for reasons like us? I it makes no sense. I mean, that's why I really have a lot of problems with copyright, because it seems to be really self-inflicting wounds when you could do a lot of positive things. And I speak from my Beatles life.
Well, we even noticed, so in the 1990s, James Briscoe puts out an anthology of contemporary American composers, women composers, to use in the classroom, to learn that music, for it to be studied. And it's an anthology that has printed music, and it has a set of CDs that go with it, a set of three CDs. And the symphony is in there because, of course, at the time, yeah. the score is in there because at the time, the score, it was Pulitzer Prize winner, of course you'd want to look at this. So we eagerly, we have the score, the anthology, in our library here, but we order from another library the CDs, thinking, aha, we finally found it. And it is the one piece on that anthology. So here's a piece that clearly music theorists, musicologists have wanted to study, wanted to teach, and they're unable to do so because they can only look at the score. They can't play it for the students. And I mean, we've listened to some of her other orchestral pieces,
yeah.
and there's, you know, such an impact on being able to hear the timbres instead of just imagine them. And especially because her music, and as we can talk about, it is kind of freely atonal. But it's also timbral. I mean, there are a lot of really, yeah. I mean, just looking at the score and the way that she's used and her other pieces, the way that she uses the orchestra is really rich. And we can't orally talk about that because all we have are the printed notes.
Right. And this is, you may recall for dedicated Hearing the Pulitzer fans, we had this situation once before.
It happened one time.
Yeah. Only one other time. It was with Douglas Moore's
Giants in the Earth.
Giants yeah, in the Earth opera. Yeah. That was the only other time, but that was a long time ago. And this is just very odd why we're not able to do it. So I don't even really feel very comfortable giving any sort of analysis beyond basic details, because music is meant to be heard, and you know, you can just look at it. And I know in the composition world, this is a common thing where you look at scores and for competitions and things like that. And you may not have recordings, but as a theorist, I use my ear for so much, and I would want to hear how all these, like you say, I mean, the score, we have the score here, and it won the Pulitzer Prize, also won the first prize Kennedy Center Friedheim Awards in 1992. So it's another award.
It's right. It's clearly a celebrated work.
Yes. And it's got a great, you know, list of the instrumentation, and the performance notes are interesting. The horns have different effects. Horns are very important here.
You always want to point out the horns, though.
Of course. I mean, if there's all, yeah, my students will tell you they're tired of hearing me talk about the horn parts in Beethoven symphonies. But yeah, there's all this interest, and she's been recorded on all these labels. The bio has it all there. Theodore Presser, major publisher. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we just have what we have. So it's best we can say it's dedicated to Ralph Shapey. It's in three movements. It's a lento, sort of slow movement, actually all pretty slow. Lento, second movement, lento, third movement's faster, con moto maestoso. So yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I listened to her concerto for orchestra, which was the CSO.
Well, I thought that we might put in a little clip here of the opening of the concerto, just so you can get a sense of her musical style, the way she uses the orchestra, just the first couple of, you know, 30 seconds of the concerto for orchestra. So, I mean, it gives you a sense of the richness of her musical language, but also the kind of complexity of her musical language. That we're talking about a composer who is, and when we talk about Ralph Shapey, preview of the next episode. We talk about his Pulitzer journey. You can hear a lot of kind of overlap. I mean, it is clear that the kind of shapey influence on her music, but there are also these moments of tension. I think freely atonal. There's nothing to grasp onto. No, she does have these markers that you can grasp onto as you work through the piece.
Yes, it was not, you know, yes, freely atonal, but in comparison to our last winner, Mel Powell, with the duplicates piece, we both had a hard time with that one. I didn't find the same experience with this one. It seemed, maybe it's from her experience as a pianist and being really intimate with that concert piano world, whereas the maybe Powell's jazz stuff didn't quite translate as well. I found there was just, your ear would go to lots of different places in this concerto and the excerpt you played. And so I think the symphony's probably in a similar vein and would be interesting. She talked about how she wanted to write a symphony at some point.
Well, she wanted to play the Philadelphia Orchestra, which historically has a very famous sound. It was known mid-century for its rich, velvety sound, and she wanted to hear the Philadelphia Orchestra play a symphony, so that's why she writes a symphony. She also said at the time, whenever she won the Pulitzer and was interviewed in the New York Times, said, "I'm not interested in music that's one-dimensional, where what you hear the first time is what you get. I think music must reflect life, or at least life as the composer sees it. I like to think that my music has been gradually evolving, that it's a natural thing, because one is always looking for new challenges, new ways of saying things." Hmm. And that kind of organic growth, the atonal organic growth, I think is a good way to think about, at least the music of hers that we've heard composed around the time of the 1990 symphony.
Yeah, definitely. And then later on in that same interview, she mentions that she wants her music to have to challenge both the mind and the heart, and to do so in equal fashion. So it's not, she's not just a cerebral composer like maybe some of the others we've had in our stable. There is this kind of accessibility factor, not in it's C major kind of thing, but timbrely, or your ear is interested. You're kept interested in what's going on. So I think that is probably the case in the symphony too.
So if any of our listeners have access to a recording of the 1990 symphony, we would love to hear it.
You had to have bootlegged it, or you brought in a tape recorder.
Anything, we would love to hear it. But hopefully this is the last in our trek through the Pulitzers that we come across an important piece that hasn't been recorded.
Yeah, it's frustrating. I think maybe some of our colleagues who study early music face this too, although that's better now than it used to be. But for a piece that's from 1990s, I think it's really inexcusable not to have a commercial recording of this.
And a composer of this stature.
Yes, exactly.
Well, it's time for us to talk about, at least, it's hard to say hit or miss, but at least we can talk about how it fits kind of into the time at which it won.
Hit or miss?
All right, Dave, you want to start with our jury report? We do have the jury report.
We do have that. Yes, we do. So the 1991 Pulitzer Music Jury unanimously recommends as its first choice the symphony. And it talks about premiered by the Philadelphia Orchestra. Shulamit Ron's symphony embraces extremes of intense introspection and sweeping dramatic eloquence. It is virtuosic in its use of the orchestra. That's very clear from just looking at it. And it's in its command of an advanced contemporary language. Oh, makes sense.
It does.
The second choice was four movements for piano trio by Bright Shang. As third choice, the jury recommends Wild, a symphony in three movements by, I know, one of your favorite composers, Charles Fussell.
I was just listening. And I didn't know if it was Charles Fussell. Oh. That falls trippingly off the tongue. We'll have to look up Charles Fussell. We don't know. I've never come across that composer's name.
Never, no. So the jury, very intriguing here. We have a couple of septuagenarians on this, two former winners, septuagenarians, and then a music critic. So one winner goes back all the way. Let's play trivia here. This is all the way back to 1951 or 52 winner.
Well, the first decade of the prize.
Who's been on the jury several times recently.
Wow. I'm at a loss. 1951.
That's The Crucible.
Oh, Robert Ward.
Robert Ward was the chair at 74 years old.
Wow.
He was the chair. Second winner was actually
one of our... I was hoping it was Chalmers Clifton, I know that he had already passed on at this point.
Unfortunately, Chalmers here. The 1986 winner was also a member for Wind Quintet number 4.
Oh, George Pearl.
George Pearl. And then Martin Bernheimer, who was an LA Times classical music critic. So those were the three. And then that's it. Says there's no list available containing the number of applications. This was premiered by the Philadelphia Orchestra, as we've talked about, not with Riccardo Muti conducting, but with Gary Bertini conducting on a program of Overture to Magic Flute.
Okay.
Then the Ron Symphony, Intermission, and Symphony Fantastique.
What a fascinating place to put it. I would not have paired it with those pieces.
No.
Interesting. And the fact that it's the first half.
Right.
It would seem like a substantial premiere you would want to put there on the second half. They wanted everyone to end with the Symphony Fantastique, I suppose.
You had to keep the people in the seats, I guess, for that.
Well, when asked about winning the Pulitzer, Charlotte Ron said that she didn't know about it until 4:30 p.m. on the Tuesday that they announced it. So how she missed, because usually it's early in the morning.
Right.
How she missed it. But she said, when asked about how it had impacted her, she said, well, I'm trying to keep my appointments, do the things I had planned to do, and go about my life normally. But I imagine for the next few days that might be difficult. I've not done anything except speak on the telephone since Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah, so finding out, we love these stories.
Love the stories about how people find out about they've won the Pulitzer.
Yeah, so a friend called to tell her she won the prize. Hadn't we had somebody recently who had the same?
That seems to be a kind of common occurrence.
Bolcom told us that was the same
experience, that someone called to tell him he had won the prize for the new Etudes.
Yeah, exactly.
What's fascinating to me about this win is there seems to be, I mean, we've talked about these kind of shifts, that in the early part of the 1980s, there was really kind of a neo-romantic movement, late 70s, early 80s, neo-romantic that kind of turned to a more populist style, but complete about face here at the late 80s into the 1990s. Now we've seen these winners back-to-back who have been pretty hard-edged, in some cases almost serial, but definitely atonal. I mean, you talk about Mel Powell for Duplicates last time that we said was a miss for both of us, this very... pointillistic, serialist style. George Pearl,
yeah,
who was on the jury for his Wind Quintet No. 4, was serialist. And then, of course, Roger Reynolds, very cerebral composer who won in 1989 for Whispers Out of Time. And even the Bolcom.
Yeah, that's true.
Was not kind of, we typically think of Bolcom as being this kind of polyglot composer, pulling a lot of different styles in. But the 12 new Etudes are pretty abstract. I mean, they have some programmatic elements to them, but pretty abstract in terms of their musical language. So the Pulitzer seems to be really appreciating at this point in history, in the late 80s into the early 90s, that kind of hard-edged, academic, atonal sound.
Yeah, and again, we always like to talk about what was left out here. And so in one of our previous recent episodes, we had the never-awarded John Cage certificate. Okay, so they're trying. They're trying to get out of this, maybe. But minimalism is starting. Certainly, by Steve Reich was very well known.
And by this point,
Philip Glass had operas at the Met, and so that's been
selling millions of copies of CD.
I mean, Glassworks and all that. So John Adams, Nixon in China came out in
1987. So right around this time.
So it seems like it's an intentional decision to ignore these other genres and just keep focused on this style. I don't know, do you think it's kind of a last gasp? Or
I think it is. Yeah. I think we're going to see something change as we move into the 1990s. There'll be a change away from this kind of style into, I imagine, a much more populist style. They're just thinking, especially once I know where they go in the 2000s as they get to that point.
Definitely.
Well, hard to say. We can't say hit or miss.
Yeah, we have to say it's a nothing, no answer.
I mean, it's a miss in terms of our chance to hear it.
Yes, big time.
But we can't say how we would feel about the piece.
No.
We would like to hear it again. A plea for any listener who can help us. Well, that's it for this episode of Hearing the Pulitzers. As always, you can find more about this project at our website, hearingthepulitzers.com, where you can watch Shulamit Ron. We'll be sure to post her performance with the New York Philharmonic. And we'll also include a short bibliography where you can read more about her work. Also, follow us on Facebook and X at H Pulitzers for links between the episodes, and be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to help people find the show. Thanks to listener Bob Pop Bob 1962 for his kind review on Apple Podcasts. And he wrote and said, "I'm writing a review now that I'm out of new episodes to enjoy. Seriously, though, this podcast is a wonder. In recent years, I've been ranting and raving, mostly seems like ranting about the winners of the Pulitzer, under the assumption that winners back in the day represented the best of the best. While that was occasionally true, now I know that more often than not, the committee has selected winners based on friendship and professional connection," which is absolutely true.
Dead on.
"So many truly important works and composers have been purposely ignored. Your work has made me finally get over 2018. Thank you for taking time to produce such an informative and entertaining podcast. 1991, where are you?" Well, here it is. And again, we apologize for the huge, huge gap between episodes, but we wanted to make sure that we had tracked every lead down to be able to let you hear a little bit of Shulamit Ron's symphony. Well, join us next episode when we'll discuss Wayne Peterson's orchestral work, The Face of the Night, The Heart of the Dark, and one of the most controversial decisions in Pulitzer history. Until then, keep listening.